Okay, so this morning we're going to continue with right effort, and in other words, how to deal with the mind, how to deal with the kind of thoughts we don't really want to have, and to move the mind in the right direction towards more wholesome states, wholesome qualities. And this sutta we're going to look at now is Majjhima Nikaya number 20. It is here called the removal of distracting thoughts. Really what it means, the Pali word vitakka santana, quite literally means the calming of thoughts. That's quite literally what it means. There's nothing about distracting there. Any thought can be regarded as distracting, perhaps, depending on the context. So it's just a general removal of thoughts. And this particular sutta is probably the most general one that we find in the Pali, in all the Pali suttas, in how to deal with the mind. So it's a very general, and it gives different methods on how to deal with this. So this is quite useful. And what we were looking at yesterday is really only one of these five methods that's talked about here. So an important sutta, and I don't think I talked about this sutta last year, so it's a good opportunity to do so this year. So this is how it goes. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove and at the Pindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to five signs. What are the five?" So pursuing the higher mind, the adhicitta, this is a synonym for samadhi, specifically the jhanas, the four jhanas on the Buddhist path. And we will see that later on in the sutta, that this is all moving towards that. So it is basically, it's a movement towards the unifying of the mind in samadhi. So these are things that we use to get to that point. And from time to time, he should give attention to five signs. The word sign here is a Pali word, nimitta. And as we often talk about samadhi nimitta, or we talk about nimittas in meditation. But in the suttas, it often has a slightly different meaning. And here it means something like cause or characteristic. The five characteristics, or five causes, or perhaps even methods, five methods that we should give attention to, so as to move the mind in the right direction. So this word nimitta that we often talk about actually is very broad, has a very broad usage in the suttas. It is used in many different ways. And further down in the same sutta here, it is used to mean something like, almost like the object of meditation or the object of consciousness. Almost, although object is perhaps the slightly unfortunate word, because object kind of gives a tendency to something, tend to look at something as something very real. So characteristic might be better. There's always just ways of looking at things in Buddhism rather than real entities as such. So there's five methods for how we should deal with problems when they arise. And so we should go with the first one here. Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign there arise in him evil or bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with hate, connected with delusion, then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him, and they subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, or extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind might become steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. So here you are giving attention to some sign. What does that mean? Well, basically it's just the object, right? You're sitting in meditation, you're watching something, And that thing might be the breath, it might be some loving kindness object, whatever it is that you use, death contemplation perhaps. And while you are observing whatever it is that you're observing, because you are doing that, whatever it is, some bad unwholesome thought arises at the same time, right? Or you are watching the breath and then suddenly you start thinking about somebody, and owing to that thought, you're thinking about that person, something, bad consequences follow, desire or aversion or whatever it is. So this is the problem. So there's some signs. It says sign here. The reason why the word sign is used again, you could use object, but the idea is that it's not inherent in that object, these qualities. These qualities are things that we often project onto that object. It depends on our mindset. It depends on all kinds of things, right? So the hate or the negative aspect is not in that object. It is something that we add to the thing. And because it is something that we add, it is easy, it is relatively easy anyway, to change our viewpoint, to change the way we look at that object. So this is the point here. The sign is really how we relate to the object. That's why it's called sign. And the negative aspect here, the unwholesome aspect, is always in terms of desire. It says hate here. Hate is a very strong word. It's any kind of ill will, right? Any kind of dosa is the Pali word. It literally means fault of the mind. And delusion, which is moha, which could also be confusion, right? Restlessness, sloth, and all these kind of things. So then you give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. In other words, you move the mind away from that negative viewpoint to something good instead. So how do you do that? And this is what we were talking about at length yesterday here. Any object, anything that we contemplate, any person, any situation is often very complex. And you can see that person, you can see that situation from many different angles. And especially, you know, if you're on a retreat like this, you know, your people are around you all the time. Sometimes we irritate each other, right? It's just the nature of things. It's impossible. It's almost impossible to find anybody in the world who has never irritated you at least a little bit, right? It's just the way we are. It's not the fault of the other person. It's not really our own fault. It's just the connection like that. It just works that way. It tends to be that way. But then you remember that, you know, why am I getting upset over these tiny little things when there's so many good things to be seen? And this is the wonderful thing about going on a retreat like this, is that the general tendency of everybody here, you can know already from scratch, from the outset, or is it like the default mode, it's wholesome, it's good. People would never be willing to kind of go to, it's almost like a prison for some people, right? You go to a retreat center, you've got all these rules, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, right? So people who are willing to do this kind of thing for progress, to make themselves more pure, to be more kind, wow, it is an amazing thing to do, and it is a very powerful thing to do. So just remember that. Remember, you know, all the good qualities that are there, all the positive things that are done, and you can be sure that they are there in a group of people like this or other groups of people, wherever it is you are. And then you can shift your focus. And this is one way of doing it, is that object you have, remember it's complex. Remember it's how you look at it, and develop the other side. And this is what metta is all about. Metta is about developing that viewpoint of seeing the good in other people. Right? This is part of what metta is about. Seeing all the good qualities that are there. And sometimes you need to develop that, right? You need to remind yourself again and again. And after a while you think, yeah, it's true, isn't it? It actually is a lot of truth to that. It may not be obvious straight away, but then you build it up. And the more powerful that perception is, that there are good things to be seen, the more easy it is to shift your attention. Let's say you're meditating, you see something is going slightly wrong. The more easy it is to shift your attention from that negative state to the positive state, because you have built up already a powerful perception of the goodness in certain people or whatever it is. So this is one way of doing it. You stay focused on the same object, right? And you just shift your perception regarding that object. Sometimes the object may not be easy to lend itself to seeing good qualities. Sometimes there are people in lives that we find just simply difficult, right? Very hard to deal with. And what do we do then? And then it's this other thing that we're talking about yesterday. You shift your perception not to see the good qualities, but you shift your perception to have a sense of sympathy with a person who has so many bad qualities. Because you know that they are creating suffering for themselves. They're creating suffering for others. They're just being stupid. It's got nothing to do with you. It's to do with them. They are deluded. They don't know what's going on. And then you can shift, instead of shifting it from negative to positive, you shift it from feeling upset because it's affecting you to actually looking at the other person instead and then seeing compassion is really the right response in this kind of situation. You just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Got nothing to do with you. Got to do with the other person. They are worthy of compassion if they are that blind to their own problems. This is another second way of then shifting your attention from one sign to another sign, right? The third way is to change the object entirely. And just to sort of, this may not be the best way because then you're kind of in denial. You don't really want to sort out the problem with this other person. It's better to be able to sort things out because once it's sorted out and you have actually dealt with that, then it is much less likely to arise again in the future, right? You have been able to see the person in a new light. It means like you are resolving that situation in a more deep sense, which is actually very, very useful. And it will come back much less strongly in the future. But if that is too difficult, sometimes it's just a matter of changing object entirely and just say, I don't want to think about that person. And then place your mind on something positive, something nice, something which makes you feel better instead. That's another way. Think about another person. Put it back on the breath. Think about, wow, I'm here on retreat. You know, there's so much, how wonderful that is. And just reflect on, you know, whatever it is that makes you feel happy. And then that is another way of letting go of that object. So this is what is meant here by give attention to some other sign. It's quite obscure English, right? It's not so obvious what these things mean. So sometimes it's good to have a bit of background in reading the sutta so you know roughly what is meant by these kind of things. So that is it. And then when you do that, it says here, those unwholesome thoughts, they use the word evil here, but the word, I think a better translation is just bad, papa. Those bad thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion or delusion, they are abandoned as a consequence of that. And then when they are abandoned, the next thing you do is that you steady the mind internally, you quiet it, you bring it to singleness, and you still the mind, right? And this again is another way of saying that you take the mind into deep meditation, into samadhi, into the jhanas. This is what this is all about. This is what this means. So you can see again here the same progress we were talking about before, right? You start off overcoming the negative mind state. You bring up a wholesome mind state. And once the wholesome mind state is there, it is relatively easy then to bring the whole mind into a state of samadhi as a consequence. There's a stepwise process that you have to that you follow, and you have to get those steps roughly right. And then you have the simile here again. Just as the skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, or extract a coarse peg, right? The coarse peg are the bad thoughts by means of a fine one. So you use the good thoughts to remove the bad ones. So this is the same idea. So all pegs eventually are bad, right? But the coarse pegs are worse than the fine pegs. So it is a gradual movement from coarser to more refined, just like the carpenter does. I'm not sure if anybody does that these days, remove a coarse peg by means of a fine one, but maybe that was a method they used at the time of the Buddha. Anyway, so there you are, method number one. And then if that doesn't work, then the question arises, what do we do then? Sometimes it doesn't work, right? The thoughts persist in the mind. And this is one of the reasons why it's important to catch these things early. thoughts have momentum, just like physical objects. And once the momentum becomes very strong, right, it has an inertia, it's kind of moving forward very fast, has a power of its own, then it's very difficult to stop that thought. You actually buy into it, right? You really believe what you're seeing. Initially, when the thought is building up at the beginning, you haven't actually bought into it fully yet. You don't fully kind of, you know, it's quite relatively easy to stop. But once the thing is really moving and you really believe what you're seeing here, it is very hard to change and to see things differently. So important to catch these things as soon as possible. Okay. If, while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, connected with ill will, and connected with confusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome. They are reprehensible. They result in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with ill will, connected with delusion, are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied eternally, quieted, brought to singleness and stilled. Just as a man or woman, young, youthful, and fond of adornments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck. So too, when a bhikkhu examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. So this is very similar to the previous sutta. Right, we're talking about seeing the danger in things. This is like using wisdom again, seeing that these things, they lead to problems, they lead to suffering in the future. Why do you really want to create suffering for yourself and for other people? Only if you are deluded would you possibly want to do that. So you see the danger in them. It says here, they are unwholesome, reprehensible. I can't remember what the Pali word is here anymore, but they, anyway, and they result in suffering, right? This is the most important one of all, perhaps. They are unwholesome, they result in suffering here. And that, of course, is always the powerful thing, that if anything results in suffering, then why on earth are we doing this? And then we have this powerful simile here. Right, I'm not going to go into more detail because this is very similar to what we were looking at yesterday. How to remember the danger in things, how it is afflictive for yourself, afflictive for others, etc. And then this very powerful simile here about unwholesome mind states, right? Very, very strong. It's like you get a carcass, right? The dead snake or a dead human being or a dead dog hung around your neck. It's very, very powerful simile. But this is kind of the idea that unwholesome thoughts, they are that bad. If you really understood the danger of these things, you would feel as humiliated, as disgusted, as if you had a dead animal, a dead human being hung around your neck. It's disgusting, right? Especially if it starts to decompose, etc. It's really, really disgusting. And in the same way, this is how, if we understood the power of these negative thoughts, that's what we would, how we would regard it. So this is ideally, this is how you feel when you see the negative thought. You think, oh no, this is terrible. You know, I've got to do something with this. And again, it's important here to understand what kind of thoughts are the worst ones. And the worst ones are the thoughts of ill will. These are the most powerful and negative states. And these are the ones I would recommend you to focus on, at least first of all. And if you want to focus on thoughts of desire as well, you can, but that is more difficult, and it creates more commitment to see that. But ill will is always the overcoming that always gives a very powerful, is the kind of most basic, and very powerful results come from that. So that is what I would recommend you to focus on among these things. It's the most easy to deal with. So try to see this ill will as something terrible that humiliates and horrifies you a little bit, right? And once you get that feeling that these are dangerous, then it is so much easier to move away. It's like the simile of the hot coal, right? By accident, you pick up a hot coal and suddenly you realize, actually, I'm holding a hot coal. This is crazy. And you throw it away. Okay, so what if that doesn't work? If while he's examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come up within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too, when a man tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. So here, another method again. So we are seeing here an organized sequence of things, right? Starting with a most powerful one and then moving down, so to speak. And here it is just a matter of not giving attention. This is amanasikara. Forgetting here, the Pali is asati. So asati can mean not being mindful of, not being aware of. It also can mean just forgetting about these things. So how does this work in practice? And the way it works in practice, you're sitting in meditation, right? You're watching the breath or whatever, and suddenly this thought intrudes into your mind, something you don't really want to think about, but it kind of comes in. So when you do that, you just very gently, you go back to the breath again. You go back to your method of loving, your object of loving kindness, whatever it is. You bring the mind very gently, very carefully back to the original object. You don't pay attention. You don't allow that new object to, grab your attention, and so you focus on that. You bring it back to the original one again. Remember, when you bring the thought back to the original object, in this case, you have to be very gentle with the mind, right? Not kind of push things aside too forcefully, say, I don't want to have anything to do with that, and then grab onto the breath or whatever. If you use too much force, then there is even more chance that bad object will arise again afterwards, because there's something in the mind which wants that to push through, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't be there. So if you use force to push it away, then the mind will not like that. It feels unpleasant when you use too much force. And then there's actually more chance that the unwholesome object will arise again. So you have to be very gentle here, very, very gentle. You know, coax the mind very carefully and say, no, I don't want to go there. You know, this is just painful. Move it back to the other object. Or don't even go back to the other object. Go back to the beginning of the meditation and go back to the body. Feel what the body feels like. Often, if an unwholesome object arises in the mind, it will also have an effect on the body, right? Unwholesomeness usually makes the body a little bit more tense, a little bit more something happens with the body. So by bringing the attention back to the body again, you can actually feel that effect in the body and then relax again, make sure the body is at ease. Then the mindfulness comes back. Then you can go back to the breath. Sometimes you have to use these strategies to make sure that you don't use too much force. Because with force, there's always tends to be negative repercussions afterwards if you do that. So this is essentially what it is. You place your attention somewhere else. You don't allow that object to stay in the mind. You attend to something else instead. You forget about that, and you're just looking in a different way. This is like the man, the simile here, of the person who see something, right? And then either you shut your eyes or you look in a different direction. You look somewhere else. You don't want to see that object. That's really as simple as that. It sounds simple, but of course in reality it's not necessarily quite that simple. So that is the third one of these ways of abandoning the unwholesome qualities of mind. Then we move to the fourth one. And if, while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion, then he should give attention to the stilling of the thought formation of those thoughts. When he gives attention to the stilling of the thought formation of those thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly, and then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand, and then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And then he would sit, and then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to the stilling of the thought formation of those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. So this is perhaps not very obvious exactly what is going on here. It is not, it is one of those things that needs, the meaning probably has to be brought out a little bit. So the stilling of the thought formation, this is vitakka sankara santana, I think. Santana means to still, vitakka is thought, and sankara is really the important word here. Here it is translated as formation. And formation is one of those words that have been chosen in translation because it's very broad and it can be used to capture this very difficult word, sankara. Very hard to translate because it has so many different meanings. And because translators like to choose one word, right? This word is the one which always is going to be used for sankara, because they want to choose one word. They have to choose something which is so general that it actually loses all kind of meaning. To me, the word formation, I have to admit, it doesn't really mean very much at all. I mean, I know what it means, something which has been formed, right? But it kind of is so vague and so obscure that it's hard to get your kind of mind wrapped around it. Sorry?
Is it a root cause? Root of the cause of these thoughts? Very root of the cause?
Yes, I'm getting to that. It's all getting there. Yeah, I'll be getting to that in a second. So, the idea of sankhara, usually how it is used in the suttas, it is used in different ways. And I often think the best way of dealing with translations is to give the same word different translations depending on how they're used. And in this particular context, and this is the standard usage of sankhara in the suttas, it seems to mean again the will, the doer inside, the things which actually creates these things. So it's really the will that is behind this. And this makes sense if you understand the nature of the mind. You know that anything you think, anything that happens in your mind, it only arises because you want it to arise. You make the choice, right? I choose to think this. This is not obvious because it is a very, very subtle matter. But actually you choose to do these things. And because you choose, you also have the possibility to allow that will, that choice, that volition which lies behind the thinking here, you can actually allow that to die down. And when you allow that to die down, when you calm it, you still it, santana, when you still the will, then the thought itself gets stilled. Because you are stilling the things which drives the thinking, makes the thinking come into existence. And this is one of the kind of the basic techniques of meditation practice. We talk about bare awareness. We talk about non-judgmental awareness in meditation, right? Just sitting back, just being aware of what is happening, not judging, just allowing things to kind of move on. This flow of phenomena, sense contacts, flow of phenomena moving through you, right? But you don't react to them. You're just aware of what's happening. You don't allow yourself to be carried away by proliferating or thinking about things. You're just aware of what is happening here. And what you are doing when you are just aware, this just aware means precisely not willing anything, not doing anything, not controlling, right? This is precisely what it means. And when we are not controlling, it means that we can be aware without thinking about things, without getting involved in the process. We're just standing back and watching what is happening here. So for those of you who are quite quiet in your meditation, and many of you are, you know, have that ability to be quiet, I know that from talking to you, and you're sitting back and you are aware, that means you already have that ability to just not being involved in things, allowing the sankhara, the will, to die down. And this is a good, very good thing to be able to do. And this is what he's saying here. The Buddha is saying that if one way of, you know, you see kind of the object arising, right, in the mind, and you get upset or you get desire or you feel confused or whatever, then instead of doing anything at all, instead of shifting your attention, you just keep on watching, and you go into the state of passive awareness, right? And you just watch without involving yourself. And as you watch without involving yourself, you're getting a distance to the object, and things calm down very quickly, actually. If you're able to 100% watch without involving, the thing calms down very, very fast. And this is what is meant here by this simile, right? You are going from walking fast to walking slow. Then you stand, then you sit, then you lie down. The thought is reducing very rapidly. And then it disappears as a consequence. So this is one of those aspects of letting go, is the letting go of the doer, the will, the driver of everything, the thing that gets involved in everything, and just allow things to be. This is how I understand this particular thing. And it fits very well with the way sankhara is normally used in the suttas as a synonym. It's actually defined specifically as that in the suttas. It's defined as chetana. Chetana is intention, the will, the doer. Okay, so I spent a lot of time on that one, not because it is the most powerful technique, but simply because it is a little bit obscure the way it is phrased here. So then we come to the last one, and this is also interesting in a sense. And if while he is giving attention to the stilling of the thought volition, or stilling of the will to think of those thoughts, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with ill will, and connected with confusion. Then with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. When with his teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, a bhikkhu beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind. His mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. So, that is the last method. And here is really where willpower comes to the fore, right? Here is really where you use willpower to the max to shut out that thought. But this last method is to be used with great care, right? It is to be used in the very unusual situations where something comes up which you normally find is hard to control. If you have a recurring thought in your mind, right, certain things that recur to you again all the time, then please don't use this method, because those recurring thoughts need to be dealt with in a more skillful way. This is only to be used on very unusual occasions where your meditation may be going very well. You're already going quite far on the Buddhist path. You have a sense of that you know what you're doing. You're not kind of just willfully suppressing your kind of natural, some of the natural, it's not really natural, but some of the habits of the mind. then you can use it when you have, when things are going well in the right way. But if you use this in at the wrong time, when you're not ready for it, you will often do much more damage than you will actually do good, because it will just be suppressing. Things often need to be resolved before you can suppress anything in this way. Things need to be sorted out. So this is the brute force method. One of the important things here also is that this is the last method of this of these five. This is the one that you use if you get desperate and nothing else works, right? And this is the other aspect of this. You use it if you're already doing quite well, and if you get desperate for a short period of time, then you can use these kind of things. Otherwise, I would not recommend to use it. And in general, this is one of the important aspects of the sutta, is that there's a hierarchy here, right? There is a sequence. Almost everything in the suttas is sequential. Nothing is randomly put together. We have seen before how the Noble Eightfold Path has a natural sequence to it, one thing leading to the next. We have seen the same thing last year with the gradual training. It is a gradual thing, one thing leading to the next, a gradual purification of the mind. And almost all the suttas have this evolution to them, natural evolution. And of course, you can see why the Buddha would do that, because it's easy to remember, it's easy to understand if there is a natural evolution to things. So think about that. This is one of the very important tools to help us understand the suttas, is to understand that they have a natural progression to them. If we forget that, it is much more difficult to understand what is going on. And what that means in this particular case is that the most powerful technique comes first. The most powerful one is this idea of what we might call substitution, right? Where you just change your perspective. You substitute, it's not really substitution, might not be a good way of putting it, but you're kind of changing your perspective from one thing to another one very quickly. It's a very fast and very efficient way of dealing with things. And it's very powerful, because you straight away, the mind becomes wholesome instead of being unwholesome. This is a very, very, very powerful and very, very, for that reason, very, very useful technique. So this is what really you should be aiming at in these things, right? And if that doesn't work, then you have to go to the second one, which also is very powerful. Remember the danger. Remember that this is like the carcass of a dead dog hung around your neck. It's dangerous. I don't want to go down that path. And then that also is very powerful, as we saw yesterday in the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thoughts, how to apply that way of doing things. And indeed, if you use this second method, then that, after a while, enables the first method, right? The more clear you are about the danger of something, and the more clear you are about the alternative way of looking at things, the more ability you have to use the first method, which just means shifting your focus away and shifting it towards something wholesome instead. And then, if the two first methods, which are by far the most powerful here, I would say, if they don't work, you can try the other ones. But some of these other ones are actually, they're actually quite difficult to use. You try to forget the thought or to pay attention to something else, and very often, once the thought has started to arise, it tends to kind of make its way back into your mind again. It doesn't really want to let go very easily. But again, people are different, so it's very hard to say what will, what might work for everybody. So try these things out, and as you do that, you will hopefully start to see what works and what doesn't work in your meditation. It is all these bad thoughts. The worst one is ill will, and this is what the Buddha says again in many places in the suttas. Ill will is the biggest problem, and that is what we should really focus on. Sensual desire is more tricky, because especially if you live a life where you are already taking part in sensual desire to a large extent, it's very hard to turn your mind away from that. That takes a kind of different kind of commitment almost. It takes a commitment certainly when you're a monastic, then of course you're taking that commitment on board. But some lay people as well, you know, where they live singly, for example, you just live, and there are many lay people who live single lives, and they're not in relationships or anything like that, and they live a very simple life, very simple little house, they do lots of meditation, all these kind of things. Then it is possible to apply these things. But very often, if you try to apply these kind of methods, while at the same time kind of indulging at least to some extent in sensual pleasures, it's like you get two opposites fighting each other out. And guess what wins? The sensual desire always wins, because the reason is because you're still finding happiness there, right? As long as you're finding happiness there, then seeing the problems in it, that is actually going to appear to you as suffering. So for that reason, it is that's much more difficult. And if you can just deal with the ill will, wow, you're already doing very, very well. You're already heading strongly in the right direction here. Okay, so that is the sutta on how to deal with unwholesome thoughts. Now, the next sutta here is one on... almost like an application of this, and I have talked about the methods in the next sutta a lot, so perhaps we can do that now, because then there may not be all that much to be said from this next sutta, so maybe we can just do that, and then we can stop after that. So this is about removing resentment, or removing anger, or ill will, or whatever you like. And this sutta is spoken by Venerable Sariputta, found in the Anguttara Nikaya 5. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus thus, Friend, the bhikkhus replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this, Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment, by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment, when it has arisen toward any one. What five? Here a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment toward such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment toward such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So basically this is just a summary of the sutta. We will look at each one of those in detail next. But the idea here is that this encompasses everybody, right? Everybody is included in these four categories. So there is nobody towards whom you cannot remove anger or ill will. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion one should attend to the impurity. One should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So you can see here, this is exactly what we have been talking about, right? The idea that there are different qualities in people, and if you see and you focus on the bad qualities, you move your attention to the good qualities instead. This is all that is really meant by this one. And the nice little simile there about the rag-robed bhikkhu, right, in those days, and still today as well, sometimes you see monks who just pick up rags, and they use those rags to make robes. So something you don't attach very much to, right? And when you pick up a rag and you think, oh, I can make a robe out of this, then you tear off those parts that cannot be used, right? You find perhaps the rag is on a corpse or whatever, and parts of it are just rotten and no use. So you tear those things off and you throw them away. They are rubbish, right? In the same way, you think about those aspects of a person that you are seeing that are not nice, that you don't, you know, when you focus on them, you feel a sense of ill will. They are like rubbish. You throw it out. You get rid of it. Why are you filling up your mind with garbage? It's terrible. You don't want to have filth in your mind. So you throw it out. Don't want to have anything to do with it. You understand that it's just, that's exactly what it is. It's just rubbish. So that is what you do here. And so that is the simile of the rag robe and the rag for the bhikkhu. Huh? And then the second one is a very similar kind of thing. It's this idea, again, of how we use our mind. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Huh? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So exactly the same idea. Now there's just a different set of qualities you are focusing on, right? But you are alleviating that anger, that negativity, by focusing on those good things. And again, the simile here is actually quite nice simile. You have a pond that is covered with algae and water plants, right? So it's like a pond. The algae and the water plants here, they are like the bad qualities that you are seeing in that person. But underneath those bad qualities, there's all these good qualities. They're all there. All the water that is cool and nice and beautiful just underneath. So you remember that. You remember that those qualities are there. So you sweep aside all the bad things, all the bad qualities. You push them to one side. And then you make use of those good qualities underneath to ease that, as it says here, it eases, you are oppressed by heat, right? This is a simile for anger. It is hot. It is like a fire inside of you. And then you drink from those beautiful qualities to alleviate the fire of anger and ill will. It's like you're quenching that fire by drinking from the good qualities in the person. It's a very nice way of looking at it, isn't it? And then by doing that, you're alleviating the weariness, right? When you get angry, you get weary, you get tired from that. All of that gets alleviated. The thirst, right? Anger is really you're trying to seek a solution to something. It's like a thirst in a sense. There's a tanha involved perhaps. And then that is alleviated as well. And then you feel good afterwards. So you drink from that. You're drinking in the good qualities in somebody else, right? Drinking them up, filling up your mind with these good qualities. Third one, number three. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle. Then a person might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, there is this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. And then he then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here is a person who has quite a lot of bad qualities, right? The bodily behavior is no good, their speech is no good, but they still have some mental good qualities. Here called the placidity of the mind, that means the mind becoming calm, right? They become peaceful in meditation. And it also talks about the opening of the mind. The opening of the mind, the vivarana is the opposite of nivarana. Nivarana is like a hindrance. So this is the opposite of a hindrance, like the unblocking of the mind, right? The unhindering of the mind, the opening of the mind is how Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi has translated it here. So sometimes people get these states of serenity, right? And you may know that if you know them well, you can know if they have these qualities. And then you actually rejoice and you focus on that state of serenity or peace that the person has. But here it is quite difficult, right? The good qualities are quite small and the bad qualities are kind of, you know, on either side. If you look a little bit far that way, a little bit much that way, you start seeing the bad qualities. So you have to focus, right? You have to be careful. You don't stir up the water. The water very easily gets stirred up. So you have to be very careful and very attentive. So you get down like a cow and you kind of slurp up the water and slurp up those good qualities without disturbing and seeing the other things. Right? You can see there is a very lot of emphasis here on this idea of focusing on the good in people, right? A lot of emphasis on that. It's not just that you just don't do it in the obvious cases, but even in cases where it may take a bit of work, you try to find something good to focus on, rather than instead straight away going to kind of compassion and kind of, you know, dismissing the person as bad and then thinking, okay, I'm going to have compassion for them. That's interesting. You go to a lot of trouble to see the goodness in other people before you do something else. And it's interesting why that is the case. And I think one of the reasons is that when you see the good in other people, it's a very positive thing to do, to see the good in other people. It gives you a sense of uplift, right? You always feel good when you see the positive in others. It's a very pleasant and very nice feeling. And it can never really be wrong. When you get happiness or get joy out of seeing the good in other people, it can't really go wrong with that. But if you move on to compassion and you think, oh, this person, they're doing many bad things, but it's kind of for their own detriment and they will suffer in the future. Well, with compassion, you're also focusing on suffering. That's what compassion is all about, right? It's kind of the desire to help people out of the suffering. But because suffering is so ingrained and so much part of the idea of compassion, it is very easy to get sidetracked and to feel perhaps a sense of pity or a sense of despair because of all the suffering. It's more easy to go wrong with the idea of compassion than it is with the idea of metta. So this is why I think the idea of metta, seeing the good in people, and is always more prominent. And whenever these things are talked about in the suttas, metta is always first. Loving kindness is first. Seeing the good qualities is first. Then comes karuna, number two, right? And there's a reason for that. Then comes mudita, the third one, kind of the altruistic joy, sometimes translated as joy in seeing other people having success or whatever. And then the last one is upeka. Upeka, the equanimity, is the most profound and the most difficult of all to develop fully. So there is you have a natural sequence there of things. But of course, there are situations where you really can't see anything good, right? Then you have to use the idea of compassion. And that is what is coming up next here. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village before him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, he would not reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Right? I always found this very beautiful way of thinking about somebody who is very difficult to deal with, who you see lots of bad qualities in her. And instead of getting angry about that or getting upset about that, you remind yourself they're like a sick person, right? They're sick in the sense that their mind is sick. They don't understand what they're doing. They are deluded, doing lots of bad things. And because they are sick and there's nobody to help them, this is the problem with people sometimes. You can't really help them, right? Even though you know that they're doing crazy things, they're not willing to listen or willing to be sensible about things. So what can you do? And it's like this person walking down the road and there's nobody to help them. They don't have any Dhamma, right? They don't have any spiritual teachings to give them advice. They don't have anything in their life because they're not ready for that or whatever the reason is. And then they are moving, they are walking towards their own suffering in the future. Big time, right? Here talking about being reborn in a bad destination. They're like the sick person who's walking towards death and tremendous suffering as a consequence. It's a very skillful way of looking at people who are doing, do many bad things and who are very difficult. They're like somebody who is sick. They're ill in a very real sense, in a mental sense of the word. And then, of course, when you see that, then you can give rise to compassion and sympathy instead of being anger. It's as if you're turning your attention away. Usually we think about ourselves, right? And it's natural that we are self-centered. Of course we're going to be self-centered. We are closest to ourselves. So we are worried about our own well-being. Of course we are. There's nothing wrong with that. But very often that self-centeredness actually doesn't lead to much happiness. It leads to kind of, self-concern and all kind of self-pity and all kind of problems. Actually, it often is much more conducive to your own happiness if you don't focus so much on yourself. And instead, you place the focus on the other person. So you think about them. Take away the self-concern and then concerned about the other person instead. And that then is what shifts your attitude from being upset to having compassion. It's actually great. It's actually very nice not to think so much about oneself. It is, this self-centeredness actually is often it's a big hindrance and it leads to a lot of problems and a lot of suffering in the world. So it's quite nice to shift away from that. And then we have the last one. And the last one is about the person who is perfect in all these ways. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks and delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and then, after coming out, he would sit and lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, one's mind gains confidence. So here, sometimes we get upset even by people who are very pure, right? This is just the way things are. In the suttas, people get upset with the Buddha, they get angry with him, they shout at the Buddha, etc., etc. So everybody kind of gets that sometimes. Again, it's just the way things are, the way the world works. But in this case, it is very easy to see the good qualities, right? So in this case, there is a pond, but it doesn't have any algae or doesn't have any water plants. It's just a pond with clear, beautiful water. So you drink of those good qualities, and afterwards, not only do you drink of those good qualities, afterwards you lie down in the shade of those good qualities and allow those good qualities to kind of to embrace you, and so you feel good about that. This is like focusing on the good qualities in a good person. Exactly the same way. There's so much goodness to focus on. It is very easy. And of course, this is why when we often talk about metta meditation, we often start off with a person who we respect, right? Somebody who has lots of good qualities. Because it's so easy to be inspired by all those good qualities. It's so easy to see it. It's so easy to be uplifted by it. So this is how metta meditation often begins. You take somebody who you really find inspiring in our life for whatever reason, and then you allow the metta to take off from there. So we'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but this shows you why this works and how this is affected. And friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gets confidence. You have confidence in this person. You see something exceptional, and this brings you forward on the path. And this is the distinction between, on the one hand, reading the suttas, and that can be very powerful, but on the other hand, also seeing somebody who embodies those qualities of the suttas. This is often necessary to give real confidence that these suttas actually work as they say they're supposed to work. Anyway, I think I will just leave it at that with that sutta, and it ends off as follows. These, friends, are the five ways of removing resentment by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment towards whomever it has arisen. Okay, so that is that for this morning. I'll see you again this afternoon. Thank you.